Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, it was 50 years ago when the idea for a new public TV show was developed. It would feature two rival film critics from Chicago newspapers, Siskel and Ebert. To say the plan was a success is an understatement. We'll look back at how the two interacted and their legacy. We also talk with a retiring outdoors columnist, Dale Bowman, is calling it a career. Should you rake those leaves in your yard? Well, some environmental experts say, leave the leaves. We'll learn about how high-speed rail came to be a reality in Illinois. And President Trump has repeatedly talked about crime in major cities with sanctuary policies, like Chicago. But what do the numbers show in comparison to crime rates in red states? Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It was 50 years ago when the film critics Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel teamed up for their first show. The rest was movie and television history. Here's Sasha Ann Simons.
All right, you're listening to the theme song of Sneak Previews, a classic TV show that transformed how we talk about movies. 50 years ago, two Chicago newspaper rivals, Roger Ebert of the Sun-Times and Gene Siskel of the Tribune, joined forces in front of the camera.
Bill Murray is a wacky summer camp counselor in Meatballs, just one of five new movies we'll be reviewing on Sneak Previews.
I don't know, Gene. Your review is the typical sort of blasé, sophisticated, cynical review.
I'll take the word sophisticated.
Two thumbs up or two big thumbs up would appear in a lot of movie ads. It became a pretty famous catchphrase.
Their passionate debates and thumbs up, thumbs down reviews brought film criticism into living rooms across America. Today, we're looking back at the legacy of these two critics, how they shaped pop culture, elevated film discussion, and left their mark on Chicago. We're going to hear from the show's original producer, a filmmaker that they inspired, and a historian leading a month-long tribute. At the table, Thea Flom, who was a producer of Sneak Previews for WTTW, and Paul DiRica, who's a producer of the month-long Siskel and Ebert at 50 event. That's a production of Pocket Guide to Hell, which Paul founded to engage the public in exploring history. Welcome to In the Loop.
Thank you for having me.
Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Huge smile on your face there, Thea. I have to point that out when you heard the theme song. Right. Tell me real quick, what came to mind for you?
Well, few people know where the theme song came from. Do you want to know?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Tell us the story.
So I was the original producer creating the show. And so we needed a new theme song. And the director and I went to, in the early days, TV shows, every TV show had its own score.
Mm-hmm.
So this was part of a score of an Ozzie and Harriet TV show. The episode was called Summer Vacation. And it sounded perfect for us. We bought the rights, and nobody knows where it came from.
When I first heard it, I thought it was from a cartoon.
Yeah, it does sound kind of cartoonish,
doesn't it? It's giving a little bit of Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, a little. It does.
Something like that. Something chaotic. So where did the idea for Sneak Previews itself come from, Thea? And how did you pick these two guys?
Well, the idea came from really, I think, from the general manager of Channel 11. Who television, which is a visual medium, mm-hmm. is obviously a very good place for a show about the movies. And the movies were becoming bigger, more popular. And so what happened was the program manager of Channel 11 called me into his office. I was a producer and asked me if I liked movies. And I said, I love them. He said, well, we tried something last year, and it didn't really work. Promise me you're never going to watch it. And put together a show. You can pick anybody you want. You can do whatever you want. You can create it in any way that you want. Go ahead and put together a show. So there was the Chicago Daily News, mm-hmm. which had a very good film critic. And there was the Sun-Times, who had Roger Ebert, who had a Pulitzer Prize already.
Right.
And he was, as a matter of fact, the only movie critic to have a Pulitzer Prize for 23 years.
Wow.
He always said that was because Pauline Kael didn't write for a local for a newspaper, which I don't think that's really. Anyway, and Gene, who was at the Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
So I got them together. And they were rivals. It's hard to imagine today how intense the rivalry of people who were at different newspapers was in those days. And they argued about everything. We would flip a coin to say where we were going to have lunch to plan the next show.
Wow.
Who was going to get which movie to boot the major reviews on. And together...
TV magic.
Well, I said to them at the very beginning, at that first lunch, Gene turned to me and said, just tell me why I should do this. Roger was into it right away. And I said, in my non-wisdom of not knowing all that much, because I can make you better.
Ooh.
And he said, okay.
Spoken like a really good producer.
Yeah, well, and I had a very strong notion about the show, that it was two guys talking about the movies. So we created a set that looked like a movie theater.
Nice.
People would come up to me for years and say, I know exactly where you shoot that. We shot it in Studio B at Channel 11, and it was a forced perspective. And they wanted to wear suits because they thought no one would respect them if they didn't wear suits. Mm-hmm. I said, no. Nobody wears that to the movies. You have to dress like you're going to the movies. So that's what we did. And really, very early on, I could see that it worked.
Yeah.
And I knew that it would work.
Well, it worked on people like Paul because you were a fan as a child, right?
That's right. Yeah. So
tell me why.
I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I was born in the late 70s. And if my father is to be believed, the first film that I saw in the theater was Star Trek The Motion Picture. But I would have been all of 1 year old, so I don't. Maybe I slept through it. I don't know. But I do remember in those early years, you know, my parents loved watching the PBS station in Cleveland, and you know, watching things like for me, like Sesame Street or Mister Rogers' Neighborhood or Doctor Who. But then, you know, one evening every week they would turn on sneak previews, and that theme, which led off that piece,
yes.
I mean, that's like burned into my memory, and I can still see the images of, you know, the hands like requesting the tickets and popcorn popping.
Nice.
And there would be these two guys talking about movies and, you know, having this spirited conversation about them. And then it would get me, even as a child, who was only like, you know, 4 or 5 years old, like excited about like wanting to go to the theater. And
right.
I admit, because I was a kid, I definitely thought they were in a real theater every week.
Yes. Everybody did.
TV magic, as I said. But you're celebrating this 50 years later.
That's right. And, you know, I think the fact that I was able to watch it as a child growing up in Cleveland gives you a sense of the reach of this program. So, you know, it was created right here in Chicago using two very, like, local talents, mm-hmm. right? As Thea said, writing for the newspapers here. But its influence extended so far beyond that. And I think it's something that the city should feel very proud about, right? There's only a handful of PBS programs that achieve that kind of nationwide reach, right? We know about, like, Julia Child. We've got things like, you know, Masterpiece, where they're bringing British programs.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a singular achievement. And then,
yeah,
you know, the way in which it transformed and democratized talking about films and kind of understanding them is a legacy worth honoring.
Yeah, well, it is true. Very early on, I said to them we were going to become the most popular, the most highly watched half-hour series on PBS.
Yes,
and we were.
And you were.
And the idea of democratizing talking about it, I would say to them, listen, we can talk about anything, but they have to see it in the you have to be able to point to it in the film clip. We can't talk about the director's previous movies. We can't talk about things that you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it helped to create for people who are watching a dialogue. They could talk about the acting and the lighting and the costumes and how everything all looked. And it caught on because it was real and because they were really two
right.
very smart, very good critics. They were great.
Who were known for the way that they disagreed. Let's listen.
Baldwin's movie is cheerfully chaotic and confusing, and I think it was meant to be. That's one of the reasons I liked it so much. His 48 characters are bursting with secrets and intrigues and guilts and weaknesses, passions, rivalries, and Altman presides. He lets all the family skeletons out of their deep and dark closets.
Well, now we have our first serious disagreement, because I don't think that this picture has a darn thing to say about social customs in America. I think that the biggest problem with this picture and why I didn't like it and didn't laugh at it Because I think that Altman just sets up a whole bunch of straw men and women, characters, silly people holding their ears, and priests who can't remember things. And so when you attack characters that aren't real and you make fun of people, I don't think it's funny.
I think what you're asking for is social commentary. I think this movie is a comedy.
So they really cared about the craft, Paul, and they made it commonplace to discuss movies in depth. You're also making the claim that Siskel and Ebert shaped the way that we talk about movies now. How so?
That's right. I mean, to go back to what Thea just said, the way they kind of focused on the immediate experience of viewing the film and responding to it, I think kind of empowered people to think about their own kind of interaction and engagement with films when they were in theaters. Mm-hmm. And we see that kind of playing out in the way in which film criticism has changed over the last couple of decades. So now, I mean, probably one of the places where people go to get like an idea of what they should or shouldn't see is like, you know, like a site like Rotten Tomatoes, for example.
Yeah, it's like, where do really, we go now with
right.
the, without Siskel
and I think in some ways that's perhaps not the expected, but it certainly is a legacy of what Roger and Gene were able to accomplish.
Not as entertaining to just go, you know, look it up.
Yeah.
In the
no,
what do
I
you
would
think,
say that
Thea?
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to, I mean, a little known fact that is that during the Depression, the average American family went to the movies twice a week. It was, and at the time when the show started, it was the major way that people celebrated, that people went out of an evening, and it was expensive. You had to get a babysitter, pay for the popcorn, pay for the movies. And so it was part of the culture that everybody shared in a way that they don't any longer.
Yeah.
People, the last time I was in a movie theater that was full was when I went to see Oppenheimer.
Mm. And there's a sense, too, that Roger and Gene really valued and respected audiences. They didn't want them to have their time or the resources wasted. Like Gene is always referencing the $4 cost of a ticket, which to think about today, it's like, wow, that was a long time ago.
Right.
But Roger too, right? He's always kind of thinking about like, is this a film that you can like bring your children to, right? And will they enjoy it? And trying to evaluate it on those terms.
Well, Steve James, who directed a film about Roger Ebert titled Life Itself, James also did the film, the 1994 film Hoop Dreams. He says that it's widely considered to be successful because of Siskel and Ebert's positive review. Steve was saying that he owes his career to that film. And he also says that the two men used their great power as critics responsibly.
They were careful about criticizing, I think, smaller films in a withering way because they knew that if they went after a small film, it might kill it. So if, you know, a lot of times the films they went after were the big Hollywood films, and the films that they championed tended to be the smaller films, documentaries or independent features, because they knew that they could help generate an audience for those kinds of films. And that, you know, that was an incredible use of their power on that national stage.
Yeah, this was, it sounds like about more than just the reviews for these gentlemen, right, Thea?
Well, yeah, I made a rule early on that the first probably 3 years, no foreign films, because remember, this is PBS. This is not people discussing the cinema. This is two guys talking about the movies. So no foreign films. And then the problem with really small movies is that people can't see them. Mm-hmm. You know, so ultimately when we began to review small movies, like a documentary like Hoop Dreams, which is a great documentary.
Right.
We had to say, it can be available. You can rent it from your local movie store. Look for it in a one of the cinema clubs in your area. Because really, it was a national show. And if people had no way to see the movies, we shouldn't be reviewing them.
Yeah, so then that's why they felt the need to sort of be the champion for these small films.
Yeah.
They also, you know, did this for filmmakers too, right? Often standing up for them in scenarios. So I want to hear from you, Paul, about this month-long event that we're experiencing now. What should we know?
So all over, or throughout the course of November, we're honoring the anniversary of the broadcast of the pilot episode, which Thea referenced earlier. All of the events are at the Chicago Cultural Center in the Claudia Cassidy Theater. And there's a film series in which Thea's taking part. In fact, there'll be a screening of a film, Breaking Away, which Roger and Jean loved, and Thea will be there in dialogue after that.
And that's part of these weekly screenings that were chosen by people who were close to them.
Correct.
And this was your pick, Thea, Breaking Away.
Yep. And last week we had a film that was picked by Chaz Ebert, Yves Bayou, which is wonderful, and we've got a couple of upcoming films as well. And then on Saturday, November 22nd, at 2 p.m., we're going to do a live performance that takes the format of an episode of Sneak Previews to explore the history of the show. And what that means is audiences are going to come into the theater. They're going to see two very talented performers, Steve Winchell and Zach Mast, as Gene and Roger. They're on the stage in a recreated set. But instead of watching clips from different films, they're going to watch recreated scenes from the history of the show.
A whole reenactment. Reenactments,
yes, pre-film segments done by a really great production company called Truth and Documentary. Yeah.
For the people, shamefully, like me, Thea, who have not seen Breaking Away.
Yes. Oh.
Tell me about it.
Okay. It was...
Give me the quick version.
a marvelous movie, a small, terrific movie in a year of big movies. It was an anti-blockbuster. I mean, the big movies that year were Apocalypse Now, Kramer versus Kramer, all that jazz, Alien.
Mm, okay.
And the fifth movie for Best Picture, which it didn't win, was Breaking Away. It's this beautiful movie, no big stars, no big budget.
Dennis Quaid was in it.
Yes.
Apparently.
And yes, he was. Dennis Quaid was in it and does well. And the other people, you know, they were all, and Dennis Quaid at the time, it was like, who? And this was a time of big stars, big budgets. This movie cost $2.3 million to make.
I'll have to go back and check it out.
Film. Yes.
Real quick, Paul, where can folks find out more information about this?
So if you go to the website for the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, DCASE, on the City of Chicago site, you'll find a whole listing of all the screenings plus the event on the 22nd. As I said, every screening and the event, they're all free.
Yes.
But we do ask the people like RSVP in advance.
Paul DiRico is producer of the month-long Siskel and Ebert at 50 event. It's a production of Pocket Guide to Hell, which he founded to engage the public in exploring history. And Thea Flom is the former producer of Sneak Previews on WTTW. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was fun.
And two thumbs up to Siskel and Ebert. More of Statewide is on the way. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, it's that time of the year when if you have trees in your yard, you're seeing a lot of leaves on the ground. It's tempting to rake them and get rid of them. But Jenna Dooley of member station WNIJ in DeKalb spoke with environment reporter Jess Savage, who says it might be best to leave the leaves.
Jess, I've got to say I'm intrigued. What have you found out so far?
Hey, Jenna. Yep, there's a growing movement for people to actually leave the leaves on the ground through the winter, including in our listening area.
How so?
Amy Freeman is the director of adult services at DeKalb Public Library. She saw that Bloomington Public Library hosted a Leave the Leaves program last year, and she wanted to do the same for her city. She collaborated with experts from the Illinois Prairie Wild Ones chapter and the city of DeKalb Public Works to create her presentation, and she hopes spreading the word results in action.
You save money and time and work just by leaving the leaves. We all try to be good to our pollinators most of the year in the spring and summer, so why not just continue that into the fall in an even easier way?
You can also find similar suggestions from so many different organizations, including the USDA and the National Wildlife Foundation. An article published by the USDA suggests that leaving the leaves makes habitat for species that foster pollination and keep pests at bay.
What have you been learning about the benefits of leaving the leaves alone?
The leaves provide really important habitat for lots of species, including beetles, butterflies, frogs, and salamanders. Moths and butterflies construct their cocoons in the leaves. Falling leaves are an important part of what's known as the nutrient cycle in ecosystems. Soil microbes go to work breaking down the leaves into minerals and nutrients, returning them back to the soil to be taken up into plants, including grass and lawns. It's basically natural mulch and fertilizer. They also act as an insulating layer to protect plants' roots. Tall, dead plant stalks and stems also offer food and habitat. Some keep their seed heads over the winter for birds to eat, and some are just nice places to perch. Bugs can overwinter in hollow stems as well.
That also must mean there are some drawbacks for local species if leaves do get raked up.
Yeah, exactly. Alan Branhagen is the executive director of the Natural Land Institute. He is passionate about moths and butterflies, which belong to the Lepidoptera order. He recently hosted a seminar about these animals, and he emphasized that conditions for our local species are dire.
Lepidoptera have numbers have collapsed to the point where several species in the Midwest now are really endangered of extinction. It's that bad. And I try to spin it that, you know, this group that, you know, everything that they do that they can help with gardening or supporting butterfly conservation is a win.
He said that the most critical thing people can do to protect butterflies and moths is to leave the leaves.
And it points to somewhat larger ideas about how residents are expected to manage their lawn and appearances and keep up with the Joneses, as they say.
Yeah, exactly. Amy Freeman from DeKalb Public Library highlights those societal pressures. She says many people in her life simply can't be convinced to leave the leaves.
I feel sometimes that having a nice lawn is tied to being rich or being manly or being some kind of elite, and I think we just need to let that go and do what's best for the planet.
Is there a middle ground solution?
Absolutely. The University of Illinois Extension suggests that people can rake the leaves to the side or onto garden beds or around the trunks of trees, or even to start small. Rake one part of your lawn and leave the rest.
Thanks for helping us understand what's going on under the leaves, Jess Savage.
You got it.
The retail price of wholesale turkeys this year is likely to be more expensive. An average 15-pound bird could cost around $30, according to a new analysis. Tariffs have impacted the price of turkey feed, which makes up most of producers' costs. And then there's bird flu. Yuko Sato is a poultry extension veterinarian. She says controlling bird flu would bolster turkey populations and help bring the prices down.
That's going to be a massive positive effect for the entire industry, irrespective of what turkeys or broilers or layers, whatever industry they're dealing with.
But with bird flu having already killed over 3 million commercial fowl this year, population growth is unlikely to happen. In the meantime, experts recommend consumers purchase their turkeys earlier to capture better price deals. Over the last nearly 30 years, you may have followed the outdoors columnist Dale Bowman. He wrote for the Chicago Sun-Times. Michael Puente talked with him, as Bowman calls it a career.
Dale, how does one become an outdoors writer, and why did you become an outdoors writer over, say, sports or politics?
I got very lucky. I was working in sports as a freelancer and interviewed for another job, and they asked my dream job, and I said outdoors, and 2 weeks later, they gave me a shot at it. And I had wanted to do it for many, many years. I basically knew after college when I hiked the southern portion of the Appalachian Trail that I wanted to figure out some way to write about the outdoors. And it took me 20 years to get my shot at doing it. So, well, not quite 2017.
So when you're out there writing, you're experiencing the outdoors, but you got to put that into words. So what do you do to try to capture as an outdoors writer? What do you have to do?
One, get a little bit lucky. Two, hopefully your writing skills. One of the beauties of writing is that you should improve as you age. It's not something, not like playing baseball where you go downhill as you age. You get more experience in things, you should get better at both writing and understanding the experience in the moment. And that's a key part that it took me a little while to learn, is to focus and make sure I took notes so that when a bright idea strikes you in the middle of the moment that you're getting it. So, I mean, I pretty much live with a notebook in my back pocket, and if a bright idea hits me, I write it down.
So what I find fascinating about your career is, so over the years, you've gained trust and credibility with not just fishermen, but other movers and shakers in Chicago, including White Sox and Bulls owner Jerry Reinsdorf. So how did you manage that?
Again, a little bit of luck always helps. Surviving and lasting a long time helps. I mean, I'm on second generation of readers, so that says something. The other part is, believe it or not, COVID fantastically expanded my audience. Part of it was I was the only person in sports for several months that was actually writing live stuff, because most of the sports were shut down.
Sure.
For a couple months. And it just, and the other part was people had time on their hands, they're at home, they're looking out their windows. They're seeing that they have ground squirrels, which they had never had any idea they had any in their neighborhood, you know. And so it was very fascinating. And I absolutely think COVID made a huge difference in my audience and skewed it to in a much more general direction from specifically fishermen and hunters and bird people.
You know, Dale, what will you miss most about your writing for the Chicago Sun-Times?
You know what? You might understand this. I will miss the deadline. I mean, there is an adrenaline rush in punching a deadline, you know, and nailing it. The other part when you write a good column, I'm assuming it's similar to you if you think you did a good segment. When you write a good column and you know it, or people you trust tell you you wrote a good column, there's pleasure in that. I mean, crafting a good column is much like a wood carver finishing it up and knowing that they did it.
Can you tell your followers what is next for you now?
Here's the difference is when you're doing outdoors, which is obviously something I love, it's very different when you're doing it as a job and when you're doing it simply for fun. Now, I generally have fun when I'm out doing my work, but so I'm intending to keep on doing much of what I did before, but a little more plain out, flat out traveling. And so, and not having the deadline to worry about, you know, making sure I have stuff posted and I'm on social media. And so.
Well, that's always great not to have any more deadlines. So we'll have to leave it there, Dale. Thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to do it. Good to talk to you, Michael.
Good to talk to you, too.
That's longtime Chicago Sun-Times outdoors columnist Dale Bowman. He's wrapped up his career with the newspaper. A program called National Math Stars wants to identify and support the nation's top young math minds. This school year, it welcomed its first group of Illinois math stars. Peter Medlin reports.
So you can do like these all different puzzles.
On a weekday night, 8-year-old Saleha Yuldash is in pajamas on her couch playing a game on her laptop. It has colorful characters and bright sound effects, but if you look closer, it's not a typical video game. It's math.
This is where you get your homework. So if you want to play, let's say, the 2x2 area model, you just hit play.
The Naperville fourth grader who skipped kindergarten is one of the state's first national math stars. She has Zoom classes twice a week with a math mentor and a small group of other stars her age from around the country. They study proofs on the math game platform Beast Academy and solve math crossword puzzles. And Saleha also can go to her choice of a STEM summer camp and has a $3,000 annual budget to spend on math supplies. She's thought a lot about how she wants to spend that money. She's always wanted STEM build boxes like HackPack to teach her more coding and engineering.
But they were so expensive. They were like $300. So my mom and dad said, we can't get it. So now I'm like, I can actually get it. So that's the top of my wish list.
Elena Walder-Bizantz is the CEO of National Math Stars. And she says their main program is based on both math ability and family need.
The goal is that a large chunk of these kids who might not otherwise have done so go on to not just be in STEM careers, but be leaders in STEM, right? Be inventors and researchers and founders who are creating new things and solving big problems.
Saleha tested into Math Stars last year, and the program only takes second and third graders. Walder-Bizantz says it's the youngest age where they have some data to know which students have aptitude and can engage in a Zoom class. And she says it's not just a 1 or 2 year journey, it's a 10-year system to help students all the way through high school. And Walder-Bizantz knows that sometimes makes parents skeptical. After all, the company hasn't even been around for 5 years, let alone 10.
If everything did blow up, would you rather have like all of those opportunities for your kid for several years than not at all? I think still yes.
It's grown a lot. MathStars started in Texas a few years ago and expanded into the Midwest this year. In Illinois, Walder Bezant says they're screening 10 to 15% of elementary schoolers. Saleha fell in love with math and science a few years ago, helping her mom organize STEM activities at a summer camp.
You know, in the movies, they're like the witches mixing potions. I just really want to see what happens when you mix two substances. Such a mystery.
Like a lot of 8-year-olds, she doesn't care for chores, but unlike a lot of kids her age, she's developing an app for that called Tasktopia.
Kids hate chores, period. Mm-hmm. But I think I can change that.
She wants to gamify chores, like Beast Academy gamifies her math homework and Duolingo does for language learning. And with MathStars and her STEM build boxes, she'll learn how to correctly code her app. And maybe her entrepreneurial spirit keeps growing with Tasktopia, but she's still only 8 years old. She may discover another passion completely outside of STEM in a few years. MathStars CEO Elena Walder-Bezant knows it's certainly possible since the program spans those most formative years from third grade to high school. It's a long journey, and Saleha's excited to have more tools and help along the way. She's thinking hard about which camp she'll pick next summer and can't wait to meet other MathStars students in person.
It's just like so many doors are now, from closed to open.
She and her family hope that now it's just a matter of which open door she wants to walk through. I'm Peter Medlin.
An Illinois man is part of 131 skydivers from around the world traveling to Florida trying to break a world record. Jonathan Turner has more.
Keith Paulson of Morrison, Illinois, gets a high like no other when he's literally floating among the clouds. The 65-year-old retired carpenter will travel to Lake Wales, Florida this month to participate in a very special event, a world record attempt for a global skydiving canopy formation. From November 10th to the 23rd, 131 skydivers from around the world will gather to surpass the world record set in 2007, a 100-person parachute formation in flight. Paulson has made 5,027 skydives over his career since the mid-80s. He'll represent Chicagoland Skydiving Center in Rochelle, Illinois, and has spent years training at home and across the U.S. with jumpers from all over the world to prepare for this moment. Paulson usually jumps from 13,000 to 15,000 feet. For the world record attempt, the planes will get up to 19,500 feet. There are usually 8 planes altogether carrying jumpers, about 20 in each. Each person is added gradually to the formation, starting with a 4-way diamond. The first year he tried a group formation was in 1986 at Texas A&M. Paulson's been working toward the world record for several years, and they got 82 last year in Lake Wales.
For this one, they're staging it a little different. They're going to have the baseline way go out and build. And while they're building, I'll be on the next aircraft. There'll be 2 aircraft coming at 18,000 feet, and we'll pass that diamond, hopefully, as it's built or built, just getting built.
Each jumper has earpieces to hear a radio with instructions. Paulson's been to the record try 3 times before, and it's by invitation only. Jumpers will include people from 19 nations, including Canada, Finland, the Netherlands, Poland, Denmark, Germany, and all over the U.S. He keeps in touch with people all year, including at Rochelle. For the record attempts, they do very little free fall. Parachutes open within 2 to 5 seconds.
It's a simulation. It's a, you know, euphoria. I mean, the one thing about skydiving is it clears your head of everything else. You're just not thinking about paying the bills or anything that's going on anywhere else. You're in this in the moment. And your friends, these people are just awesome.
Last year on his birthday, November 21st, Paulson bookended his day with a sunrise jump with about 12 people, and at sunset, another group surprised him.
These guys had all the radios, you know, and then then I didn't know this was coming. They started singing happy birthday to me in a formation under canopy in the sky, and it was just really cool.
Paulson said it becomes extended family since they depend on each other with their lives and have to work as a team. His wife, Andy, is a master parachute rigger who maintains all his gear. They first met when she was a student of Paulson's. They're both certified as a rigger and teacher, respectively. Paulson served in the Army at Fort Hood and first tried skydiving there in a sport club on the base in the 80s. Beginners always start in tandem with an instructor held together by a harness, and they fly together.
In that little bit of time, it's amazing how much people trust a brand new person they met, just met. They have no clue. But And it's great fun. I mean, it's like when I was a TANM instructor, you get to live through this person's right here. I mean, you're attached to the front of you, you're all facing that way, and it's like there's energy you can feed off of that. And it was a good time. I did that for over 10 years, 1,400 TANM jumps.
This is Jonathan Turner.
Statewide continues in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Several locations in McDonough County were stops on the Underground Railroad. A new mural at Macomb's Railroad Station pays tribute to the compassionate souls who live there and the courageous freedom seekers who pass through the area. Rich Egger reports.
An excited, standing-room-only crowd filled the lobby at the Thomas C. Carper Amtrak station in anticipation of the mural unveiling. After a brief presentation, the black drapes covering the three panels of the mural were removed. The artwork received immediate approval. Artist Michael Mahoney says he wanted to humanize freedom seekers by showing real people with expressions on their faces.
There's a sense of determination as well as fear.
An image of a broken chain across the mural symbolizes breaking away from the bonds of slavery. Mahoney says it took a lot of courage to escape slavery and seek freedom.
They didn't know what was going to be there, who was going to be there, what might happen along the way. Wow, that's tough.
Mahoney believes the Underground Railroad mural ties into the mural he painted of civil rights leader, the Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian. That mural is just a block away from the new one. He says freedom seekers and Vivian both fought for freedom and civil rights. The mural also highlights the rural homes of the Ellison and Blazer families. Brenda Ellison of Macomb says it's a proud moment for her family to have the Ellison farm depicted in the mural. She says her ancestors faced pushback from those who supported slavery.
They didn't want them to vote, so they had to come to town with guns blazing. So I'm from a really rebel activism type family.
Ellison wishes she knew more about what her ancestors did, but Underground Railroad conductors were secretive. They were breaking the law, so they did not keep journals about their activities. But now, their contributions in helping others escape the injustice of slavery are celebrated in a very public piece of art in downtown Macomb. Rich Egger reporting.
Well, this week we're looking at an important service for the state, Amtrak. Getting people where they need to be faster has been long in coming. Charlie Schlinker unpacks the generational project that brought faster train service to Illinois.
It took more than 30 years to bring 110-mile-an-hour passenger rail to the Chicago to St. Louis corridor. That's a long haul of feasibility studies, planning, scrapping for money, and bargaining with public and private entities even before construction began. Chris Koos sits on the National Board of Amtrak and is the longtime mayor of Normal. Even with that tenure, the passenger rail project predates him. Koos says every big project must have three things.
I would say vision, planning, and tenacity.
Early studies spoke to the potential of a 110-mile-an-hour network out of Chicago. These studies said there was a market for higher speed rail. They said it would improve air quality, there would be an economic benefit to the state and the communities connected by the service. Joe Szabo headed the Federal Railroad Administration during the Obama administration. Before that, he was a union guy. Szabo says that analysis was important to bring other people to embrace the unified vision of rail service that would cut a big chunk of time off a car trip.
It started with those of us, myself included, in the union arena, you know, meeting weekly with those in the environmental community and thinking about how do we build this out. And it was from there that we started sitting down with the president of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, with the Chicago Chamber of Commerce.
Szabo had also been a South Suburban mayor in Chicagoland. He went to mayors along the corridor and to the Illinois Municipal League, touting economic benefits for their communities. After that, Szabo added university presidents to the coalition. They saw their Chicago area students use the train to get to campus. Some doubted the economic analysis. Mayor Chris Koos says speed alone is not enough.
You know, 110 service doesn't exist on its own. You also have to have frequency, of that service, and you also have to have on-time performance of that service. So if one of those three is missing, it kind of, the other two don't stand on their own.
There were two prerequisites for success in getting 110-mile-an-hour passenger rail. Former Federal Railroad Administrator Joe Szabo says without both of them, it wouldn't have happened. The first was doubling the number of state-supported Amtrak trains on the corridor. The economic claim had been the more frequent the trains were, the more people would use them, because they have options if a business meeting time changes or runs over. You don't want to get stuck away from home at the end of a business day. When the hearings to expand state-supported rail came, Szabo says all that work assembling a broad coalition that bought into the vision made passage less hard.
It's almost like once we pushed that boulder uphill, it started rolling downhill, you know, with its own momentum.
The idea of frequency of trains was orthodox and long-known transit theory, but supporters needed to dispel doubts about the economic benefit case.
And watching the ridership explode exponentially, I mean, within like 3 months, ridership more than doubled on all the state service, and it just continued to build month after month after month.
After that, even though there were more trains per day along the corridor, they still couldn't go faster than 79 miles an hour. The second element that made the project achievable came a year or so after the increase in the number of daily trains. It was the election of Barack Obama as president and the passage of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Plan to stimulate the economy following the national financial crisis. Obama wanted to make passenger rail a part of that investment. Former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood of Illinois says it was the first time any White House had put down an $8 billion marker on high-speed rail. LaHood says Illinois got a significant chunk of that money.
More important than anything, it requires collaboration. Big projects get done when smart people put their minds together, agree on the plan, and then begin to implement it.
LaHood says the administration of then-Governor Pat Quinn had already demonstrated it had skin in the game by boosting the number of trains. And so, for the first time in eons, Joe Szabo said federal funding was made available to help state DOTs implement railroad projects. He says, sure, it was luck, but the state was ready. The analysis had been done decades earlier. Then the proof of concept came with growth in ridership and the state partnership commitment to more trains. Szabo says, though, you never know when the window of opportunity is going to open. And if you are not prepared, you are unable to pass through. And there was still a lot of work to do. Faster train speeds mean you need a better rail bed, you need to close the number of grade crossings, you need fences to stop pedestrians and wildlife from getting on the tracks, you even need better crossing gates so motorists can't make fatally poor choices to drive around the gate. Ray LaHood says any major infrastructure upgrade takes years of work and many phases.
What you find with these projects, a few people wake up every day and the only thing they think about is how do we get this project over the finish line and how do we keep it going.
Even after all that, it took years more to start running faster trains from Chicago to St. Louis. The corridor shares traffic between passenger and freight trains. Amtrak operates one, Union Pacific, Canadian National, and other companies operate the other kind. And if trains are going that fast, there's a lot less time to make a decision to stop if a slow freighter is ahead. When the vision began decades earlier, Chris Koos of Normal says the planners knew there had to be a way to let engineers know exactly where a train ahead of them is, but it didn't yet exist.
That primarily had to do with a GPS system called positive train control, which is a safety issue for trains traveling at that speed with the amount of traffic on the tracks.
Europe decided to go with a single system for both passenger and freight trains. The U.S. said every rail company could choose its own system if they could talk to each other. Former Federal Railroad Administration head Joe Szabo says developing and then testing the technology for interoperability delayed the timeline a couple more years.
Never anywhere on this planet had implementation to this scale, to this magnitude, been attempted. And it's important you get it right.
Another thing, former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says, big honking infrastructure projects are always very costly, billions in the case of faster rail service. You have to embrace uncertainty.
And it's very difficult to really calculate what it's really going to cost until you begin the project, begin the work, and try and stay on a schedule.
When you get to the finish line, it might not be the same place you thought you were going all those years ago when you started. In the case of 110-mile-an-hour passenger rail, Chris Kuss says the vision is, as yet, incomplete.
When the 110 plan was identified, there would have been two more trains a day in and out of Bloomington Normal. And that kind of disappeared in the rounder years. And I think there's still holes in the schedule that would certainly increase the usage of that system.
It's also true that when society does a hard thing, it can be a continual process that does not, in fact, have an end. Joe Szabo says you may have to keep renewing and rebuilding once it's in place.
Charlie Schlinker with that report. With 110-mile-per-hour trains now in place, the talk is started on a 220-mile-per-hour corridor. We'll have more on that next week on Statewide.
President Donald Trump and members of his cabinet have been outspoken in blaming crime on sanctuary policies in Democratic states.
We've been seeing the governor of Illinois parading out there saying that there's nothing wrong with Chicago. It's a great place to live. There's no crime there. He doesn't need President Trump's help. Well, I think the residents of Chicago beg to differ, and the statistics beg to differ.
So when you look at Chicago, they've had probably 50 murders in the last 6 or 7 months, 8 months. It's like a war zone. It's probably worse than almost any city in the world.
But the numbers don't quite tell the same story. A WBEZ and Sun-Times analysis shows many Republican-led states actually have higher violent crime rates and faster-growing undocumented immigrant populations. Here to break it down for us is Sun-Times reporter Sophie Sherry. Hi, Sophie.
Hi.
So Trump first deployed the National Guard in Washington, D.C., and then turned to Chicago. Tell us why his administration targeted us.
Right. So in early September, the Trump administration launched Operation Midway Blitz. And when they did, they said they were launching this operation to target the criminal illegal aliens who they claim have flocked to Chicago and Illinois because of the governor's sanctuary policies. And they've used this to justify the presence of now hundreds of federal agents. But since the beginning, the claim has always been that they are here to target the criminal illegal aliens who have found what they claim is a haven in the state of Illinois.
Yeah, that it's very dangerous here. But in your reporting, you found that that narrative wasn't true. What did you find?
Right. So overall, Democratic-led states like Illinois have lower rates of murder than Republican-led states. We found it was actually nearly 32% higher in those Republican-led states. And the same is true for the growth of undocumented immigrant populations and rates of undocumented immigrants with criminal records, both higher in Republican-run states. We also found that there are 14 other large cities with higher murder rates and violent crime rates than Chicago, including several cities in red states.
Right. So some of the cities in those red states that had these higher violent crime rates in Illinois, what were they?
Examples are St. Louis, Memphis, Kansas City, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Atlanta. All of those cities have higher murder rates than Chicago.
And which states saw increases in undocumented immigrants?
So over the last 5 or so years, Florida and Texas, which are both led by Republican governors, have really seen the largest raw increase in undocumented immigrant populations.
So why do you think, or what did your reporting sort of point to regarding Trump's narrative being so focused on sanctuary cities if the data isn't supporting that?
It's becoming clear that this has always been about sanctuary cities. And those policies put forth by Democratic politicians, the Democrats who lead those cities and states where those policies are in place. The Trump administration views this as a massive roadblock to their deportation efforts, and they presented it as such. Critics have been very vocal that the administration is sort of leaning on these claims of public safety threat to justify these aggressive tactics.
And what did the data show about the number of undocumented immigrants who commit crimes?
So our data showed that about 132,000 immigrants with prior convictions have been arrested by ICE across the country over the past 2 or so years. But nearly 2/3 of those were apprehended in states run by Republican governors, according to the Deportation Data Project. I mean, some may say one potential reason is blue states like Illinois have not fully participated in programs targeting immigrants with criminal records. But overall, we're seeing that the large amount of those currently in ICE detention are without past criminal convictions. Experts we spoke to say that massive deportation efforts like this have always relied on conflating criminality with immigration, but that that's a fiction. It's a tiny population of those they're actually arresting who have serious criminal records.
That's Chicago Sun-Times reporter Sophie Sherry. You can find a link to the data she mentioned at our show page. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us, and join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.